You've reached the Every Little Thing helpline. Please leave your message after the tone.
Hey, everybody. This is Jorge Just, and I have some really, really wonderful news. I'm guest hosting Every Little Thing today. That's right. Flora Lichtman is on parental leave because she's the brand new mother of a bouncing baby. Congratulations, new family. And here's the show.
Hi, this is Liz. I was just listening to the Memorable Meals show, and I was thinking about my most memorable meal. In my mind's eye, it was me eating eggplant parmesan at my great-grandmother's table, but I realized the perspective wasn't me eating, it was me in a third person looking at myself eating. So I guess my question is this even a real memory I have? Thanks. Bye.
Hello?
Hi, Liz.
Hi.
This is Jorge from You Must Remember This.
Every Little Thing.
I mean, Every Little Thing. You're right. I get it wrong all the time. You wanted to know whether a memory you have is real.
Right.
Has this happened before? Where you think you remember something and people are like, no, Liz.
Oh my gosh. It happens all the time with my husband. Like, he's always telling me, you know, no, it didn't happen that way. Or you just made that up. That never happened. So yes, I am constantly questioning my own memory.
Is it something you worry about?
I don't know. Maybe I'm remembering with rose-colored glasses.
Do you think that is a problem?
I don't know. I think I would like to have a realistic memory of things, you know?
Mm-hmm. But why does it matter? Like, what if you found out that some of your most important memories didn't happen quite the way you remember?
That's a good question. I guess maybe it's my personality that I wouldn't say I'm type A. I'm like probably a type B+. So I want to have like a little control over everything. And so maybe it's a function of wanting to remember things a certain way, or...
It sounds like you're an A-.
Yeah, maybe I'm an A-.
Somebody who sits on the couch a lot, I'm a B+. You sound like an A-. And the memory in question, is it important to you? Do you want it to be real?
I do. Yeah, I do. I think food has always been such an important part of my family. My great-grandmother, the woman who made this meal for me, was an Italian immigrant and spoke Italian, but didn't teach Italian to any of my mom or her sisters. And so I think the memory is important to me because it's like this connection that I have to my past and my heritage. And I've tried so many times to recreate this like silky, wonderful melt in your mouth eggplant parmesan. I think it's like the only reproduction I have is this memory of mine. So
it is important.
Yeah.
Well, Liz, we found someone who's really committed to memory to answer your question.
Awesome.
Hello, Liz. I'm Charan Ranganath, professor and director of the Dynamic Memory Lab at UC Davis.
Hi, Charan.
Charan got into memory research for personal reasons.
So there's a phenomenon we see called me search, where people tend to study what they're bad at. So I guess all of this is inspired by the fact that I have trouble remembering things.
Before you can forget why we called, I got right into it with Charan. How can Liz know if this memory is real?
You can never really know.
So thanks for calling, Liz. It's been really, really great talking to you.
Great. Very unsatisfying, but thank you.
I'm just kidding. All right. So to actually answer your question, we first have to talk about what memory is and what we mean when we say the word.
Everybody, including people who study memory for a living like me, will often talk about the memory. Okay, like, you know, I have a memory of blah. But that's not really how we think it works in real life. The way our brains are designed to remember is not supposed to be a recording of everything that happened.
And that's why there's more than one kind of memory. You've got short-term memory and several flavors of long-term memory, like memories about facts, for example. And then there's memories like the kind you're wondering about, which are autobiographical or episodic memory. Basically, there's no shoebox of souvenirs in your head that stores every memory. There's no photo album that you just pull out and page through or, you know, swipe through.
Mm-hmm.
So let's do some memory 101.
Okay.
Okay.
Ready.
First thing you need to know, your brain, it's a big gray electrified scrambled egg that lives in your skull.
Yes. You're definitely a dad. I can tell.
Yeah. Well, I was like this before I was a dad. That's the thing.
Now you just have an excuse. It's good.
All right. Now that we got that out of the way, let's talk about how those memories get in your noggin in the first place. Your brain works really, really hard. It's taking in all kinds of information all the time.
Hopefully.
So I'll give you an example. Let's say you run into someone on the street, right? While your body's just standing there like an idiot, your brain's actually busy.
We're seeing something. We're hearing something. There's things that we're paying attention to. All of that is engaging, you know, almost our entire brains.
Your cerebral cortex is registering that face, taking in the smells, the sounds, what the face is saying, and processing all that information on the fly.
I see.
But how does that turn into a memory? For that, we need a little seahorse-shaped squid of fatty tissue. I know everybody knows what I'm going to say.
The amygdala.
No.
Oh, no.
Close.
See, I was bad. I was bad at neurology.
The part of the brain I'm talking about, it was named after a hippopotamus college.
Oh, hippocampus. Yeah. Yeah, of course.
And what the hippocampus allows you to do is say, hey, you know, give me information about where I saw this face before. Give me information about the person's name. And so it's really kind of acting as this sort of linking hub, so to speak, that's allowing you to take information from different parts of the cortex to say, well, whatever that face was, I remember seeing that weird face at this place at this time, you know, on the Zoom meeting or in, you know, the concert back when concerts were a thing and so forth.
So the hippocampus is gathering bits of related information from all over the brain and putting it together. And suddenly, you're in a different time and place. And now you're remembering. You're remembering that face, right? That face is my middle school gym teacher. And that smell, that's her gym shoes.
Oh, God.
And that feeling, that's my anxiety about not being able to do a single push-up. And if you put it all together, that's a memory. That's your foundational memory in the story of how Mrs. Overmeyer ruined your life.
Oh, man, sounds terrible. See, that's the stuff you want to forget.
That's sometimes the brain helps you and sometimes it doesn't. And that's the thing, right? Remembering something isn't like playing back a movie. It's more like you're constantly pulling in scraps from different parts of the brain. And while some of those scraps have to do with the dinner you're remembering, others are just information connected to what you know about dinners in general. Like, they're yummy.
And so what happens is that sometimes we will say, I remember this, blah. And what we remember is really an amalgamation of details from two or three different experiences we have.
So basically, memories aren't like a snapshot of a single event at a single place in time. It's more like they're a complex marinara of experiences that are simmering in your brain pan. And all of that basically gets to why it's not always wise to trust your memory.
Oh, man.
But can you trust your memory? We'll find out after the break. We'll find out after the break. Now that we know how memory works, let's get to the recall that you called about.
Okay.
As you probably remember, as I hope you remember, we asked you to record yourself describing the memory, and then we played what you recorded for Charon.
Okay.
Here's what he heard.
I probably was 5 or 6 years old at my great grandmother's house. I believe the house was in Connecticut. Like, the house was in the woods, and I remember sort of like walking around in this wooded place. I'd never been to a home like that before. She was an old school Italian grandma, and so all of the couches were covered with plastic. So I remember sitting on these plastic covered couches. My great grandmother was an amazing Italian cook, and she made this eggplant parmesan that I had never had, you know, freshly made for me. So the memory is that I was sitting at the end of a very long dining room table with a white and plastic tablecloth over it. And then she puts it down in front of me. It was a white plate with, you know, sort of gooey, oozy eggplant parmesan on it.
And when I really think about the memory, some of the like visions I have are of myself looking down at the plate, but a lot of it is actually in this third person where I can see myself sitting at the end of this table in a chair through a doorway over the steaming plate of eggplant parmesan. And it's such a vivid memory that I almost thought it was out of a photograph. And so I asked my mother. She said no such photograph existed. So is this memory real of me watching myself eat this food?
Listening to that story has really made me crave eggplant parmesan now.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
Charon had a lot of thoughts about your memory. First, about how old you were when it happened. So you said that this was one of your earliest memories, like you were maybe too young to remember things clearly.
Yeah, exactly.
Charon says, yeah, it's true. When we're little kids, our memory is pretty crap.
So there's a phenomenon called infantile amnesia, which means that when people are, you know, under, say, 2 years old, you just have no reliable memories. And that's because the brain is literally changing so fast that it's like everything's been remodeled to the point where, you know, you can't reconstruct what happened. She was 5 or 6, so that's more reliable by that point. And so that's good.
So you were old enough to form this kind of memory. Charon also said that the way the memory came to you, right? You were listening to the ELT episode about memorable meals. He thought that was significant too.
You know, when a thing just pops into your head, that's very characteristic of what happens when you get the hippocampus lighting up and saying, hey, this puts me back to a particular place and time. And she didn't say these words, but it sounded an awful lot like she felt like she was going back in time.
Yeah, absolutely. Even now, just pulling up the memory in my brain, I can feel standing in that house and feel being there. It's not just a visual memory, it's a body memory too.
If you smell a food or if you go to a particular place, there's a feeling that you get that I've been here before. So often it's the case that we didn't lose the memory or the memory didn't disappear. It's just that we can't find it. And if you get the right clues, boom, it comes up.
Whoa. Yeah. So interesting. I mean, I imagine that your brain, obviously it's like not going to store every single little thing, but also a wonder that our brains aren't going crazy all the time. Like just being like bombarded by random memories. So cool.
Let us all thank our hippocampus.
Yes.
Okay, so far we've talked about 3 things. You were old enough to remember something like that. Mm-hmm. Plus the memory just popped into your head one day. And when it did, you felt transported back in time. All of that points to this memory being accurate.
Right.
But you'll notice the stuff we've been talking about is all about remembering.
Like the act of remembering.
Exactly. But Charon says there's clues in what you actually remember as well. The images, the sensations, the feelings, all the stuff that just comes back to you.
So one of the key tricks to figuring out, did I experience this or did I just hear about it or did I imagine it, is how much of the sights, sounds, and smells are coming back to you. And, you know, one of the things that she remembered was the furniture being covered in plastic. That's not a typical thing that people pull up when they just are thinking about what happens when you eat a meal with a relative, right? She brought up the ooziness of the eggplant, you know. She was like at the end of a long table, not just a table. There was a lot of sensory information there, which is actually pretty rare when people remember things. You know, if I'm telling a story about an event, typically I'm going to give you my writer's embellishment about what I think happened and, you know, my evaluation of it and how I was feeling and so forth. There was almost none of that in her story.
That's interesting. But yeah, I guess those are the things in my mind that makes it feel real.
Why is that?
I guess when I think of myself recounting stories, I am an embellisher. Like I do make things more dramatic than they maybe originally occurred. But yeah, there's none of that in this story or this, not story, but in this memory, it feels like it's a very just like honest portrayal of something that happened in my mind. But then I like keep coming back to that like vision of me through this doorway sitting in this chair as a third person. Like, where did that come from? Like, that had to have been made up somewhere.
So we asked about this. And Charan said that there's some preeminent researchers who believe that experiencing a memory from your own perspective, so not like a fly on the wall, that that's a requirement for this kind of memory to be true. But in your case, Charan thinks that it might just be the act of remembering that changed your perspective.
What often happens is there's an initial feeling of being there, and then you start making sense of it and constructing the narrative. And that's when it can be more third person-y, you know, and feel like you are telling a story rather than re-experiencing the event. And that doesn't mean it's false. It doesn't mean it's true. It's just your experience at the moment pulling up that memory.
Like that if I'm, when I'm trying to recall the memory, I'm making the memory at the same time.
Yeah. In fact, that it is likely that when we recall an event, that we are actually forming a new memory. And so when we call up a memory every time, it's like we're not just playing it back, we're also hitting record.
Oh, cool.
Your memory of that dinner becomes intertwined with the act of remembering. That's why sometimes you're an observer in your own memory.
I see. And how, like, you know, it's so interesting, like that, who knows when that like third person view happened? Like it could have been when I remembered it when I was 10 or like, you know, because this is just a compound thing that's probably developed over 35 years.
Right, exactly. But whenever it's from, you shouldn't consider it proof that this memory isn't real.
All right, good.
But I do have some bad news for you.
Oh, man.
This memory probably has changed just by you talking about it with us.
I don't want to keep remembering it then. I want to keep it pure.
Might be too late, Liz. I asked Charan about that. So since Liz first called, we've talked to her a few times and we got her to record that.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm curious, like, did we F up the experiment by talking to her about the meal? Does that change her memory?
The answer is probably, because the act of asking somebody about what happened is producing all sorts of changes. So when people try to recover a memory over and over again, or they hear about an event over and over again, that's when things start to become, you know, rewritten or revised.
Rather than a pristine archive of all of your life experiences, neatly arranged on a shelf, organized for quick retrieval, your memories are actually stored in a soggy box filled with crap in that corner of the basement that sometimes floods. That's basically what it was like. And we also learned that your childhood memory of eating arroz con pollo on a plastic tablecloth at your great-grandmother's house in Puerto Rico, like the moon landing, that probably did occur. Maybe not exactly in the way you remember it, like a detail shifted here and there. But Charan said that even when memories do get shifted around, lots of times that's in your favor.
People on average have a positive bias in their memories. So, you know, as you get older, people are more optimistic when they reminisce about events.
That's so interesting.
How many times do we get together with relatives or friends and we recall something that was actually unpleasant and we laugh about it now, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so that distance gives you a little perspective. Just that act of looking back alone can be enough to sort of bring out the positive aspects and kind of dampen the more irrelevant stuff that just didn't matter. I mean, yes, it matters to have this kind of sense of the buttery eggplant, and that in and of itself is satisfying. But there's also the feeling that you had, that feeling of being loved or cared for, that mm-hmm. is, you know, kind of in some ways the most precious parts of our experience.
So I'm going to sum up. These are not his words, but I think that what he's saying is, memory, all alone in the moonlight, I can smile at the old days.
Sounds terrible.
I was beautiful then.
No, no. Definitely not.
Every Little Thing is produced by Hagar Eldas, Caitlin O'Keefe, Stephanie Werner, Phoebe Flanagan, Annette Heist, Jorge Just, and Flora Lichtman, with help from Nicole Pasulka and Doug Barron. Edited by Caitlin Kenny. Scored by Bobby Lord, Emma Munger, and Dara Hirsch. Mixed by Dara Hirsch. ELT is a Spotify original podcast. Welcome, Baby of the Year. Goodbye.